This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Thursday, the 27th of June. No audience and a mute button. So what else can we expect from tonight's first US presidential debate of this campaign, at least between Joe Biden and Donald Trump? We'll hear from our correspondent in Atlanta, Georgia, where the debate is taking place, and get some pre-spin from the Democratic and Republican parties. We have a report from Sean Lay on innovation in the NHS and ask how innovative the main party's healthcare proposals really are. Plus, Keir Starmer's problem with Britain's Bangladeshi community, and the DJ Bobby Friction on South Asian music's arrival as a force in its own right at this year's Glastonbury Festival. Two candidates for the highest political office in the land going head-to-head in a key election debate. If that gives you a sense of déjà vu after last night's encounter in Nottingham, just spare a thought for the American public, because in a few hours' time, Biden-Trump the sequel will take place in Atlanta, Georgia. The original was 4 years ago when the two men previously stood against each other for the presidency. Well, this CNN-hosted rerun, the first debate of its kind featuring two US presidents, could be a pivotal moment in what appears to be a tight contest with 4 months still to run. The presumed Republican and Democratic nominees, remember neither of them has officially been chosen by their parties yet, have a long history of trading barbs on stage and on social media. Well, now the 45th and 46th presidents, aged 78 and 81 respectively, get the chance to do it one on one. Well, this was what that sounded like in 2020.
Gentlemen, a lot of people have been waiting for this night, so let's get going.
Nobody has done what I've done. Come on.
This guy has a dog whistle about as big as a foghorn.
Joe, I ran because of you. I ran because of Barack Obama, because you did a poor job. If I thought you did a good job, I would have never run.
Mr. President, let him answer.
He doesn't want to let me answer because he knows I have the truth.
Question, why
because,
would you answer that question?
Because the
you
question
want to put a
is,
lot of
the
new
question
Supreme
is,
Court Justice, the radical
question,
left.
Will you who shut
is
up,
on,
man?
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
Gentlemen, is, I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
He's going to pack the court.
We have
end,
no, no.
Not going to give a list.
We have ended this segment.
That was really a productive segment, wasn't it? Keep yapping, man.
It is going to be a bit different this time, as I've been hearing from our North America correspondent, Anthony Zerker, who is in Atlanta. First, though, how much anticipation is there ahead of the debate?
I think there's a lot of anticipation because, unlike past presidential debates, this one is happening very early in the campaign. It's just June. Usually these happen in September and October. So in a way, this is setting the stage for the campaign to come, and it's going to give it a chance for both candidates to define the terms of the campaign, the key issues that they want to highlight, and also address some of the doubts that Americans have about both candidates, doubts about Joe Biden, his age and his fitness for office, and doubts about Donald Trump and his temperament and why he's running again, whether it's more than just revenge and retribution, what he would do if he gets a second term in office.
What about the format? It's an interesting one, isn't it? There's no studio audience and there's a mute button. Tell us a bit more about it and what kind of impact it might have on the occasion.
This is a format that the Joe Biden's campaign pushed for. They were essentially able to set the terms of this debate because Donald Trump, leading up to it, was saying that he wanted to debate Joe Biden anytime, anywhere, the sooner the better. So he ceded a lot of ground to the Biden camp. The Biden camp issued these rules with which they would agree. And as you mentioned, there will be a mute button so that when one candidate is talking, the other candidate's microphone is muted, so you won't get that kind of back and forth. You won't get the interruptions that you heard in the first Trump-Biden debate in 2020, where it really degenerated into kind of a rhetorical food fight. And so it is going to be a quieter, more restrained kind of environment. And maybe the hope is that that will lead to quieter, more restrained candidates who can discuss the issues in a more mature sort of way. Although I'm not sure if there's any way of guaranteeing that.
As you say, this is such an unusual timing of a debate like this. I think it is the earliest, isn't it? Certainly in the television age.
Yeah.
And you've got two presidents. That's unprecedented. Put this into a historical context. It is pretty unique, isn't it?
It is very unique. You have two presidents, a former president and a current president, each with a record to defend. Obviously, there's bad blood between them. The way that the 2020 campaign ended with Donald Trump contesting the results and holding a rally that led to an attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. All of that is kind of hanging over this debate. And in addition, because it's happening so early, neither of these candidates are the formal nominee of their party yet. So some people have speculated that if the debate goes particularly bad for one candidate or the other, the party might be able to swap them out and put someone else in. That seems unlikely in the extreme, but it does kind of underscore exactly how early this is and how this could really set expectations, define the scope and the framework for the campaign to come, and solidify what Americans perceive about both candidates and maybe solidify the negative views that the American public has about either candidate.
That was the BBC's Anthony Zerker in Atlanta, Georgia. Well, let's get some pre-debate predictions, perhaps some pre-debate spin from the Republican and Democratic camps. Joining us, Brian Lanza, former communications director for Donald Trump's presidential transition team, and Christine Pelosi, Democratic Party strategist, elected member of the California Democratic Party's executive committee. Welcome both of you to the world tonight. Welcome back, I should say.
Thank you for having me.
And what do you expect? Let's start with you, Brian. What do you expect from this debate?
Listen, I think a lot of people are going to be surprised. I mean, they're going to see a focused, a dare I say, mellow President Trump. I think, you know, he's had plenty of time to prepare. From people that I talk to, he understands the stakes, and he understands that this is debate that's going to set the table for the remainder of the campaign. And if he hits it out of the park and talks about immigration, inflation, and the wars that are hitting us all across the world, you know, they expect to win this debate. But if they're talking about anything else, it'll be a wash.
Christine, a focused, mellow Donald Trump, that will be interesting. What sort of Joe Biden do you think we can expect?
Well, I think, echo my Republican counterparts' assessment here. If this is two grumpy old men yelling at each other, I think they both lose and they both miss an opportunity. If, on the other hand, they focus on speaking about the future. Look, they're both old. We get it. They're both grandparents. The first one to say, look, I'm a grandfather and I care about the world my grandkids will live in and inherit long after I've gone. And this is why I have forward-looking policies. And here's what they are. I think that person is going to immediately get the edge and hopefully inspire the other to reach that level of debate. But if they are down in the mud early, I think it just becomes a slugfest. And I think a lot of people, you might hear a groan from both of us in different parts of the country and people all across the country just saying, oh, come, quote, Biden in the last debate. Come on, man. Let's do better.
Well, look, Joe Biden, it's clear from all the opinion polls, he has this issue. He has this problem. He can't do anything about it. That the American public, large parts of it, think he's too old. He's not in a good state to do the job. What does he need to do to change that narrative, Christine?
Well, I think he has to be clear and focused and direct, answer the question that is asked of him. He loves a good story, but in a debate, you've got to be short, crisp, clear, directly answering the question. And the fact is, again, if you talk about the future and you talk about what you want to do for the future, then you can convey being young at heart. But if you're in the middle of a slugfest or a personal insult back and forth, I think Donald Trump wins those.
But what about Donald Trump, Brian? He also has a tendency to look back to air his grievances. Is that going to be a difficult thing for him to avoid?
No. Listen, I think everybody has explained to him the stakes. I think everybody has said to him the uniqueness of this debate. You have two former presidents that are on the debate stage. You know, two records to compare. That's hardly ever happens here in American politics. And I think Trump is very comfortable with the comparative record of the two. I mean, President Trump would love to have a conversation about inflation. You know, and Joe Biden's failure to even come close to addressing inflation. I think, you know, by Joe Biden's own targets, he said the country should hit 3% or 2% of inflation. He's never hit it in his entire term of president. So for over 38 months, he's failed to hit his own target of inflation, which has devastated American families. Those are the things that President Trump needs to be talking about. If he's talking about Russiagate, if he's talking about all those things that took place in the past, that's dangerous. Because, you know, if you're going to talk anything about the past, talk about your successful record and compare that against President Biden's record, which is, you know, whether it's immigration, whether it's inflation, or even wars abroad, have just been an abject failure to the American family.
Christine, what about Donald Trump's recent conviction? Does Joe Biden bring that up?
I would hope not. I honestly, when that all was going down and that conviction was happening, I had vibes back to 2000, when in the last couple of weeks before the 2000 election, Al Gore and George W. Bush were neck and neck, and somebody thinking they were helping Al Gore found George Bush's old DUI conviction. And the question is whether or not he lied when he said he had never been arrested.
Drunk under the influence, for British right. people who don't know the acronym.
Sorry about that. Yes.
Driving under the influence even, sorry.
It was a drunk driving conviction that was several years old, and Bush had been sober for 20 years. And even people like me who didn't like him liked that part about him. And it completely upset Gore, because people were talking about Bush's past and not Gore's plan for the future. So similarly, I hope Joe Biden doesn't bring up Donald Trump's past or a more immediate past, but instead talks about the future. I would argue the Inflation Reduction Act is a good thing to talk about. I would argue that women's rights are a good thing to talk about. Again, talk about us. Don't talk about each other.
Now,
for God's sake, don't yell at each other.
Now, you're both talking up for what they need to do. But is there a real risk that if it goes horribly wrong, given that neither of them are the official nominee, things could change between now and November in terms of who is running against whom? What do you think, Brian?
No, I mean, listen, this is, you know, Donald Trump is the Republican nominee. Joe Biden is, you know, I mean, Christine can talk better about her party than I can, but he's the Democratic nominee. I think the only way for at this particular moment for it to change would be if Joe Biden were to resign the presidency. And I just don't see that happening.
Christine, any thoughts? Is it possible that there could be a change?
I don't think it's possible that there can be a change. I think, look, both men are the presumptive nominees of their respective parties, and that's the way it is. And so for people who are watching thinking, oh, if only there's a stumble, and then there's this, and let's be honest, great white hope waiting in the wings in either side to take over, that's not going to happen. That's not where the Democratic Party is. It's not where the Republican Party is. Right now, these are the nominees, and they have to be seen as such. So rather than assessing the debate as to whether or not somebody stumbled so badly they should be replaced, I think it's better to say, did somebody perform to where the Democrats are going to be running with and not away from Joe Biden, and Republicans are going to be running with or away from Donald Trump? That's really the key when it talks about being the standard bearer of your party going into your convention.
Christine Pelosi, Brian Lanza, thank you both very much for that preview. And you can watch and follow live coverage of that presidential debate on BBC News, BBC One, the BBC iPlayer, or the BBC News app. Special coverage begins from 1 a.m. You can also listen on BBC Five Live or on BBC Sounds. And coming up later on this programme, the opening this evening of Glastonbury's first ever dedicated area for South Asian music.
It's not the first time South Asian music's been at Glastonbury, but it's basically been few and far between. There's been a takeover of a stage 20 years ago. There've been bands like Asian Dub Foundation and Nitin Sawhney have played there, but this is an entirely different creature. It's an official stage.
It's that boogie baby.
More boogie baby from Worthy Farm before the end of the programme. now to the election campaign in this country, because some of the most pointed exchanges in last night's leaders' debate were over illegal immigration, with Rishi Sunak pressing Keir Starmer on what he would do to clear the backlog of people waiting to have asylum claims processed. That followed a similar line of questioning for the Labour leader from Harry Cole of The Sun in the leaders' interviews that were hosted by that newspaper on Monday.
I'll put the staff back in the returns unit. I'll make sure that we've got planes going off, not to Rwanda, because that's
where
an expensive. That's an expensive gimmick. They will go back to the countries where people come from. That's what used to happen.
Where are they? But I mean, it's so hard to do.
Well, at the moment, people coming from countries like Bangladesh are not being removed because they're not being processed.
Well, singling out Bangladesh in that way has led to quite a bit of anger in parts of the Bangladeshi community here, especially after that clip was re-edited to falsely suggest that the Labour leader was talking about the repatriation of British Bangladeshis. Today, speaking to ITV News in a rather noisy room, Sakir clarified his comments.
All I was saying in the debate the other day was that so far as asylum returns are concerned, Bangladesh is a safe country and actually one of the countries which has a returns agreement with the UK, which is a good thing. I certainly wasn't intending to cause any concern or offence to so many of the British Bangladeshis who are making such an enormous contribution.
But that wasn't enough for the deputy leader of the Labour group on Tower Hamlets Council in East London, Sabina Akhtar, who has resigned from the party. Well, both Labour candidates in the council's two constituencies are of Bangladeshi heritage. It's one of the parts of the country with a large Muslim population. And in those places with large Muslim populations, Sir Keir Starmer's stance on the war in Gaza has been creating quite a challenge for his party. Earlier, I spoke to Sabina Akhtar. And what was her reaction when she heard the Labour leader's comments?
I couldn't believe it. So I replayed the interview a few times and I was like outraged. Like, actually, did he single out my community? And he did. And that's how I found out. And when I went to pick up my cousin from the school gates yesterday, the outrage outside the school gates, everyone was talking about it, from the residents to the community. And remember, here in Tower Hamlets, we've always been a blind supporter of the Labour Party, from our forefathers to everyone in the community, Muslim Bangladeshi community here in Tower Hamlets. And across the country, we've always supported the Labour Party. It's meant to be the party for us ordinary people, and we have been singled out.
So, yeah. So was it this alone that led you to resign, or had this been coming?
So there were things that, like, hear someone coming in interviews, and you can see he's trying to please a group of audience, and it really felt painful. It hit my community to the worst, and his previous interviews in LBC and stuff, of course that hurt our community as well.
So that's the one about Gaza, right? Initially after the war started, where he talked about whether or not Israel had a right to
that
block
really
water and food.
Yeah, absolutely. And the outrage in the community. But still, I stayed in the party, even though I was really, really upset with his comments.
But to resign a week before the election sends quite a signal. Do you not worry that it might have an impact on the result of the election?
The thing is, he will win, most likely. You can see from the polls. He will be the prime minister. But he needs to understand the community in Tower Hamlets and up across the country, you cannot take our vote for granted.
Do you think this is going to do real damage to the Labour Party in constituencies like yours in this election?
Yes. Everywhere, you see, this is the top of the talk. Everyone's talking about it, every household. Before, our older generation who used to always support the Labour Party, now the younger generations are very, very angry. If you go to Abara, you see the outrage.
That was Sabina Akhtar, who has resigned from the Labour Party in Tower Hamlets Council. Well, joining me now in the studio, Sundar Kantwala, Director of British Future, a think tank dealing with immigration, integration and race relations. Good evening, Sundar.
Good evening.
Let's start with the comments that have caused all this controversy. What was the policy there that Sir Keir Starmer was getting at?
What he's trying to talk about is a little-known part of the asylum rules now, where asylum processing has stopped under the Illegal Migration Act, and his policy is to start processing again asylum claims. And if we processed asylum claims, then people from Afghanistan, Syria, 98-99% would be accepted. But another part of the policy of not processing claims is there are countries with quite low acceptance rates, 1 in 10 from India, about a quarter from Bangladesh, countries like Pakistan and Nigeria, where most claims would be refused. But if you don't hear the claim, accept some, refuse others. You can't operate the returns deals you've got. And you've got returns deals with relatively safe countries, functioning governments, Commonwealth countries like Bangladesh, Nigeria, India, that you would not have, obviously, with Iran, Afghanistan, Syria. So in that sense, it's saying this is a trusted partner. But obviously something else has been heard. If you just say we can't send people back to Bangladesh, people think it's about something much broader.
Well, that's right. He singled out one country. That seems to be where the problem lies here.
I think that would be an error. I think, you know, of the 10 countries with lots of claims, I mean, it's 3,000 claims from Bangladesh, you know, India and Bangladesh happen to be the countries where, you know, there's a lower acceptance rate and a returns deal, but you've suspended your returns deal. And so either government would actually have to assess the claims. We're not going to send hundreds of thousands of people to Rwanda, and, you know, you've got to do something with them. But if you'd named two or three countries, you wouldn't have that sense. So people have said, is he dog whistling? Is he trying to stigmatise a minority community? I doubt there's any intention to do that. You've got to be very careful with your language, because for Commonwealth minorities in this country, the language of sending people back, of course, also has the echoes of Enoch Powell and the echoes of the National Front.
And we know already from the local election results that clearly the Labour Party's stance on the war in Gaza has had consequences amongst Muslim voters. What is the bigger picture? What is this telling us?
Yes, I mean, the local elections, there were big impacts on Labour's votes among Muslim voters, especially in places like Birmingham, much less in London, where Sadiq Khan did very well. In national polls of Muslim voters, they're holding up quite well. So how we read that is you could go different ways. But I think a lot of British Muslim voters are probably quite cross-pressured between the argument about change and the economy and the NHS and the argument about Gaza and Palestine, where they're critical of the government and very critical of the Labour Party as well. I think younger voters, people for whom this crisis is a moment of socialisation, are probably much harder for the Labour Party to get than some older voters. So Labour's probably going backwards with Muslim voters and no other group, although it's probably still winning, you know, more than half of Muslim voters in this election.
Since we've got you here, I just wanted to ask you about another story that was in the news bulletin, what we heard tonight, that Reform UK has condemned some of its own campaigners for racist and homophobic remarks they allegedly made, recorded by Channel 4 News. What does Reform's continued polling success say about the debate over immigration and race here?
Well, Reform appeal to a part of the, probably a quarter of the country probably strongly likes what Nigel Farage has to say about this being an immigration election. And for other people, it's a cost of living election or an NHS election. Reform has condemned some of its campaigners after this report today. What's changed in the last month since Nigel Farage took over from Richard Tice is Richard Tice was suspending candidates who had been selected who were shown to be very virulently or overtly racist, and Nigel Farage has stopped doing that in the last month. So there's a boundary that he insisted on keeping. It's why he left UKIP, that UKIP had invited in Tommy Robinson. He's got candidates such as his Southend candidate using the most virulent language about murdering asylum seekers, and he hasn't suspended that candidate. So I really think he should be suspended.
He has condemned those comments, though. So thanks very much for that, Sundar Kantwala there. Well, Sundar said for some it is an NHS election, and we're going to turn to that precisely now, because with a week to go before polling stations open, one subject that does indeed remain at or near the top of voter concerns is the state of the NHS. The main parties are promising to support new technologies and greater innovation to help tackle waiting lists and to deliver better, more cost-efficient care. In a moment, we'll hear from the independent health charity, the King's Fund, on the challenges facing the NHS and what the various parties are offering. First, though, the World Tonight's Sean Lay has been to Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge to hear about a number of initiatives being trialled there. He began by meeting Nurse Charlotte, one of those staffing the hospital's virtual ward scheme, which monitors patients in the comfort of their own homes.
So you have a temperature reading, an oxygen reading, a blood pressure reading, and then a heart rate reading. So it's all the observations you would normally get on the wards.
But with patients who are on the virtual ward, how often would you or one of your colleagues speak to them, actually have a conversation with them?
Yeah, so it does vary between 1 to 4 times a day.
Oh, right. So it's always at least once a day?
Oh, it always has to be at least once a day to check in, to make sure they're stable like you would do on the wards. So I have to confirm their name and date of birth. Hello there, it's Charlotte, one of the nurses from the virtual ward. How is your mum doing today? Is she okay? That's good. That's good to hear. So no leakage from the wound overnight at all. Good.
So my name's Ian Goodhart. I am the clinical director for virtual wards here at CUH. The technology sends the monitoring data to us within a minute of it being recorded.
Is there a medical benefit from your point of view of getting the patient home sooner?
Hospitals are dangerous environments. We know that hospital admissions are associated with risks. Falls, hospital-acquired infections are probably the two most common, which are most difficult to prevent.
Now, the other side of the virtual ward. We've come about 10 minutes out of Cambridge. Ring the doorbell.
Hello!
Leslie, it's very nice to meet you.
Excuse me, not getting
No, listen, don't worry. Hello Thank there. You for letting us disturb your afternoon.
My name is Leslie. I'm 92, and I've been in and out of Addenbrookes for rather more occasions I'd really like. And the last time was a few weeks ago, and they said, we're going to transfer you to the virtual ward. You're in the comfort of your own home. You can use your own normal facilities.
In your own bed, and presumably you can sleep a lot better than you can on the ward.
Well, the answer to that is yes. Even though you're at home, you've got all the facilities, really, because they arrange a time and they phone you every day, and the consultant came out.
Just as if you were in the ward and they would have come their round and their visit, they actually came out to you at home. Yeah.
And he was absolutely brilliant.
The party manifestos have a lot to say about health, but there's surprisingly little detail about innovation in healthcare. Labour says it would develop a strategy to ensure innovative ideas are adopted across the health service. The Conservatives put a figure on the funding of new technology, £3.4 billion, to be delivered, says their manifesto, through the National Productivity Plan.
Right,
so out through the Rosie Birth Centre.
There.
Ah, OK, that's the hub.
That's the hub.
You might think one way to get more bangs for your buck in hospital is to build up. A new specialism, add another floor. In fact, Charlotte, who's organised our visit, is taking us to a single-storey building which opened just 6 months ago. Presiding over it proudly, Professor Andrew McCaskey.
So here we arrive in where the patients will come.
So we've got a waiting area here.
And then they all just proceed when ready and called for through this door. And you can see three state-of-the-art theatres down that corridor and that very short journey.
From reception, you go to the area where your readiness for an operation is assessed, from the assessment area straight to the theatre.
The effect that has had, for instance, means our length of stay, so there's one example, has shortened. Because
from
of those
what to what, on average?
Approximately 2 days less than it was before.
Vicky.
That may sound modest, but 2 days saved on each case creates the space to treat more patients. It's not called the Movement Surgical Hub for nothing. The team want you to keep those joints moving, especially the ones like 64-year-old Derek's new right knee.
Can we just get you out of bed one last time and check your walking?
Yeah, of course. I've only been on these for less than 24 hours. It's quite amazing.
So from my point of view, you're going to be good to go home this afternoon.
Good.
And you're going to do all your exercises 4 or 5 times a day?
Yes, miss.
OK.
As soon as I came in here, it was sorted within 3 months. It was unbelievable. So I was waiting just to see the surgeons. I was waiting about 2.5-3 years. But as soon as I saw the surgeon this time around, he realised how bad they were. And he says, right, we need to get it sorted. And they've got it sorted, yeah.
Yet there's a trade-off here. Efficiencies can come from scale, something the Addenbrookes campus is formidably good at. The politicians, though, are talking about delivering more services close to the patient. The Conservatives aspire to invest proportionately more of the health budget outside of hospitals. Labour wants to move to a neighbourhood health service delivered in local communities. How that's done takes us well beyond this election campaign, or indeed the next Parliament.
So this is one of our very fancy modern radiotherapy machines.
Raj Jenner is an oncologist, a cancer doctor who treats patients with tumours of brain and spine. The other half of Dr. Jenner's time is spent on research, most recently on Project Osiris.
This is the part that the oncologist does, is they look at the scans, and what we're interested is in to mark out very carefully where is the tumour that we're targeting.
Addenbrookes may be a cutting-edge medical campus, but it's not immune from the staffing problems of the NHS. One in five of its oncology posts is unfilled. It may have the scanners to detect cancer, but it needs specialists to interpret what the scanners show. Dr. Jenner has developed an AI which has learned to recognise healthy cells that need to be shielded from the radiation therapy. Before surgery, a doctor had to map precisely where the radiation could be applied. This precise but time-consuming task is now handled by the machine, which processes the data in an instant and doesn't make the mistakes that an oncologist might make when tired.
In 2017, a patient with prostate cancer would have been seen in clinic. You'd have pressed the go button with your oncologist to prepare radiotherapy and you'd have started in 31 days. That's the national target. Yeah. We now, basically, because of Asieris, we try and start treatment within 15 days.
So that's half the time.
So that's half the time you're staring down the barrel of a gun waiting to start your cancer treatment.
Oncologist Dr. Raj Jenner ending that report from Sean at Addenbrookes Hospital in Cambridge. Well, listening to that, and with me in the studio is Sarah Woolnough, Chief Executive of the King's Fund, the leading independent health think tank. Nice to have you in the studio, Sarah. Let's get on to what the parties are offering in this election in just a moment. Perhaps we can start with what we just heard in Sean's report from Addenbrookes. How important are innovations like virtual wards or AI in tackling some of the underlying challenges the NHS faces?
They're critical. And we heard and you see when you go out and about in the NHS, fantastic examples of innovations, some technological new medicines, diagnostic tests that mean that people's conditions can get diagnosed more swiftly. So there's a range of fantastic stuff in the NHS and coming down the track. One of our issues is spread and adoption and wide scale adoption of this sort of innovation, which is sometimes difficult. And I think partly because the NHS is running so hot. Any change, any new innovation needs to be introduced. People often need to be trained to understand how to work new machinery or, deliver radiotherapy in a different way. That takes time. It takes effort. It takes people, and time and people are things that the NHS is lacking.
Running hot, as you put it. What about cooling it down then? You've looked at the main party's health and social care policies for England. What stood out for you in them?
Well, there's quite a lot of similarity in terms of the signalling, actually. So the main parties talk about this need to shift more care closer to home.
The virtual wards.
The virtual wards, but also primary and community care. So this idea that, we essentially have an NHS that doesn't differ massively to the NHS we had 75 years ago, in the sense that it's still often a sickness service. We need to encourage people to stay well, to prevent disease. And bearing in mind we've got an ageing population, many more people living with multiple conditions, how can we help them, in part through technology and innovation, look after themselves and manage themselves at home? So the parties are signalling that. They're signalling the need for action on social care. They're signalling the need to tackle things like capital maintenance. We have hospitals that are falling down, but at most we think they're a down payment in terms of the detail that's offered on the quite big change that's needed, bearing in mind we've got 6.5 million people on waiting lists. None of the performance metrics that the NHS measures itself on have been met for several years. There is a huge challenge, compounded by the fact that we have a sicker population. Life expectancy in the country has stalled over the last decade. In some groups, it's even worse than it was 10 years ago.
And what about money? And that's always the big one. What do you sense from the various manifestos in terms of how honest the parties are being and where they intend to get the money from?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's where this point about down payment. So there are some concrete measures. For example, Labour is saying 40,000 additional appointments a week, evenings and weekends, and there is some money set aside to deliver that. You also need staff to deliver that. We've got a bit of a workforce crisis. We've got high levels of stress and burnout. So I think the manifestos tell a bit of the story. They don't give a detailed sense of quite what it'll cost to get us back to where we need to be, bearing in mind satisfaction with the NHS is the lowest it's ever been in the 43 years that we've been recording it.
And briefly, in terms of timescale, I mean, for example, we've had Keir Starmer saying, look, we're not going to get social care fixed in this next parliament. Is that kind of honesty? Is that the sort of thing that people want to hear?
Well, I think better to be honest, because the scale of the challenge is vast. But I think we have got to, on social care, we can't keep kicking the can down the road. And the Labour manifesto is really a plan for a plan. So if we're serious about having a sustainable health service for the years to come, we've got to get serious about tackling some of these issues, tackling social care, moving more care out of hospital settings and delivering the workforce plan that various parties have committed to.
Sarah Woolnough, Chief Executive of the King's Fund. Thanks very much indeed.
Five, four, three, two,
That was Glastonbury organiser Emily Evis unbolting the green gates to Worthy Farm ahead of this weekend's festival. Well, thousands are already camping out there, perhaps some of them. Some of you are listening to us right now for a bit of calm before three big days of live music and all the rest. Well, one innovation at this year's Glastonbury is the festival's first ever space dedicated to South Asian music. The DJ and BBC Asian Network presenter Bobby Friction is one of those behind the space, which is called Arrivals. Before it opened its gates about an hour or so ago, he told me more about it.
We're in the Shangri-La area, which is the famous offbeat, quirky, anarchistic area of Glastonbury. The outside looks like a Bollywood cinema. Granted, it's a bit psychedelic as well. It's very bright and neon. And our theme is basically South Asian science fiction. So you actually walk into a kind of Bollywood movie set in the 25th century.
But it is a fact that this is the first time Glastonbury has had a space like this dedicated to South Asian music. What does it mean, do you think, this?
Well, it's not the first time South Asian music's been at Glastonbury, but it's basically been few and far between. There's been a takeover of a stage 20 years ago. There've been bands like Asian Dub Foundation and Nitin Sawhney have played there. But this is an entirely different creature. It's an official stage. It's supported by Glastonbury. We kickstarted it after meeting Emily Evis. One of the missions of this is to not just see South Asian artists, but to train up the next generation of South Asian sound engineers, you know, lighting people, festival workers, because there's even less South Asian and also people of colour at a place like Glastonbury than even your average high street.
Is it a different looking Glastonbury then this year?
Not quite. I mean, it's still very white, which is fine with me. I've been coming since 1992. It's very middle class as well. And I just think in this day and age, in the 21st century, whether it's colour diversity or gender diversity, but actually more importantly, class diversity. You know, like I was brought up with lots of white working class brothers and sisters who still stand with me and I stand with them. We're friends for life. You know, you come to Glastonbury and literally you're like, oh, this is the British middle class at play. So not quite yet, but things are changing. I mean, for an example, first Glastonbury I went to in 92, I counted the South Asians I saw on my travels for those 4 days on one hand. There's definitely hundreds, if not maybe thousands, but still not enough.
Baby steps, baby dubstep.
That's a good one. I might have to steal that. It's a boogie, baby.
And what about broadening the appeal, perhaps, of South Asian music? Is that what could come out of this?
Yes, for me, that's one of the main missions. I don't want this music to just be called South Asian music and look at all these South Asians listening to it. Isn't it lovely? I want it to become globally dominant. Afrobeats isn't just listened to people from the continent of Africa. The same with Latino music. It's completely broken out of it, South America, and infected the entire world beautifully. Southeast Asian pop music, K-pop. I mean, look at that. The time space between no one really knowing about K-pop outside of South Korea and it taking over people's lives, literally only about 4 or 5 years. In this day and age, if you're a 10-year-old and you're listening to Spotify, the chances of you listening to music from anywhere in the world is so high. I just think, you know, the world is there for the taking.
The DJ and presenter Bobby Friction speaking to me from Glastonbury. Now, before we go, a quick look at tomorrow's front pages. The Times headline reads, "Shoot illegal migrants," said reform campaigner, referring to comments recorded by undercover reporters. The Daily Telegraph front page headline is, "Farage is a Putin appeaser," says Sunak. And The Guardian leads with, "Labour pledge to ban managers who silence NHS whistleblowers." That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami from me and everyone on the programme. Have a very good night.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.